CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Hi, dear listeners. This is Kate Riga. I'm here to make a quick pitch that you consider becoming a TPM Prime member. TPM has used the member model for over a decade now, and our loyal members are the only reason we've been able to weather the turbulence of the media landscape and avoid the fate that has befallen so many other independent outlets. For $70, you get no paywall, fewer ads, access to the Hive member forum, a members-only newsletter, and more. For $140 a year, you get all of that, plus no ads at all. Without our members, there is no podcast, not to mention that I'm out of a job. Thank you so much for listening and supporting us. We couldn't do it without you.
This is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast with Kate Riga. Last night we had Super Tuesday, which, you know, that used to be Super Tuesday used to be at least on one side of the, you know, one side of the party divide. It was like a pretty big thing. Usually in most years, you basically know where things are going, but it's going to be where one candidate, wherever there's the contested primary, it's usually where the, you know, the last stand of the person who's losing, or when the dominant front runner is going to kind of, you know, put it to bed, basically. And obviously yesterday we didn't have either one of those things, because it's been clear to anyone who's paying attention for at least a year who the party nominees are. And at least yesterday, we finally got to the point where mainstream news organizations now feel able to say, okay, now we have the nominees. Trump is the nominee. Biden is the nominee. Obviously, that was helped to a significant extent by Nikki Haley announcing that she's getting out of the race. But there we are. We're going to get into, you know, there's still a fair amount of things to discuss there. Before we do that, Kate and I are going to just hit briefly some other news that came out a little before the election news came out. And I don't know, I have to imagine that couldn't have been accidental. It's kind of the way to kill a story if you're a political person. But we finally had Kyrsten Sinema announce I could have announced it for her a year ago or 2 years ago, that she's not running again, which, you know, in a sense, I guess she was kind of the last to find out she's not running again. You know, I'm not terribly broken up about it, as I'll let Kate get into it. But I thought she had a nice way of sort of summing up the little announcement speech that Sinema gave. She actually, even beyond the ways that I think you could see this in the cards back in, you know, back in 2002, maybe even back in 2001. But even more recently, she hadn't been raising money. There was, you know, filing deadlines, and she had to get signatures and stuff. So I think for the last couple months, it's been pretty clear she's not going to run. And, you know, the reason, in addition to not wanting to lose, it also became pretty clear that if she had run, she would have ended her political career, at least this phase of her political career. I can't imagine she has a future one, but this phase of her political career, not just losing, but probably like coming in third with like 8% of the vote. And that's like, I can't think of any time in the last half century that there's been anything remotely like that. I mean, why do that? You salvage what dignity you can. But Kay, what do you think? I mean, first of all, give us your reaction to the speechlet, I guess we would say.
Yeah, what great commitment to the bit kind of up until the end. She did this really long video and the thesis was, I put it in my piece, it's not me, it's you. And that's what it was. It was about, I do all this great stuff. I do this bipartisan work. I do it well. That's not what you people want. And that's not on me, you're wrong and that's your choice. And that's the note I'm going out on.
Let's agree that you suck. The
exactly.
People use, yes. Which, probably all losing politicians do, but she has a way of putting an especially fine point on it.
Right, exactly. And then I guess as she was leaving the chamber yesterday, a reporter spotted her and asked, do you have anything to add to your statement? And her staff person kind of was mocking the reporters for asking questions and she was laughing, which is just, it's the codish the way it's been this whole time, right? This is kind of been the theme of the way that she has conducted herself, at least, in the second half of her Senate term. It's been sticking a thumb in the eye of her party and its leaders, sticking a thumb in the eye of the voters who worked to get her elected to this role, disrespecting reporters and kind of freedom of the press norms on the Hill, being one of very few senators who refuses to take any hallway interviews and who will only kind of talk to the press in these very predetermined little inviting friendly reporters into her office setups that, resulted a few times over those 2 year stretches with Kyrsten Sinema doesn't care what you think type pieces. So, I mean, that's how it was all along. That's how it ended. The only real mystery here was, from the whole vantage point of her political calculations being completely baffling for the past 4 years. So it made sense to everyone with eyeballs that she has no chance in this race. The best she'd probably do is spoil for Ruben Gallego and perhaps get Carrie Lake the seat, that she would lose and lose pretty profoundly, right? That she's become radioactive with Democrats, that Republicans kind of only like her because she makes Democrats mad and not in any deeper way than that. So, I mean, that's been clear to all of us, but it wasn't clear that that was ever going to be something she understood, because kind of per this coda to her whole career, her political calculation was, I'm going to be a dick in public in these big splashy ways that really anger Democrats, whether that be the curtsy flourish when you vote down the minimum wage, or maintaining devotion to the filibuster and opposing carve outs for abortion and voting rights, which, I said in my write up yesterday, those are the beating heart of the Democratic Party right now. Those are not the kind of issues where people from purple states can be like, well, I got to take a little distance on this. I got to show I'm not just in lockstep. I got to be tough on the border. I got to be tough on crime. That is the ultimate litmus test for a Democrat in the early 2020s, that she was like, no, the filibuster is more important to me. So the only kind of question was, does she still fancy herself this mavericky person who does these dickish things in person or in public, and then does this behind the scenes kind of bipartisan legislating work, which by all accounts she was pretty good at. She seemed to be an integral part of the big kind of Republican buy-in packages that passed in the past few years. But if that was the calculation, that just shows how politically tone deaf she is. What she thought these big attention grabbing kind of, fuck Democrat maneuvers were going to fade into the background, and that the anonymously sourced reports about how she works well with Republicans would tilt the scales back in her favor. She's been a baffling figure. We've talked about this before, coming up through these liberal Green Party politics and then taking this hard turn to the corporate right as soon as she gets into the Senate. It's never made sense. It made even less sense when, she was twinned with Manchin this whole time, who the politics he was working with, anything he ever gave Democrats was a gift. It really was. And for her, if she had governed like a normal Democrat, she would be well into her reelection campaign right now, with the support of the party. She made herself completely radioactive, drove herself out of politics. And as I say, the only suspense with this decision was kind of whether she would come to that conclusion herself.
Yeah, it's really you know, at least for the moment, Arizona and Georgia, which are kind of like, you know, the Democratic promised lands in electoral terms now, they both have two Democratic senators after not having any Democratic senators for a very long time. And she was the first of those, right? I mean, she didn't win it with, like, you know, kind of Trump having Giuliani, all that. You know, she won it the sort of the old-fashioned way. She kind of, you know, worked her way up the ladder in Arizona over a number of years. And she did a lot of, not the bad part of politics, but networking and fundraising, all that kind of stuff, that's what you do. And it was a genuinely big accomplishment. And so, as you say, it's the whole thing just remains totally baffling to me why this happened. I mean, I think, you know, in some ways, it always seemed like she had looked at John McCain's record and completely misunderstood it. That, you know, McCain's thing was being a reliable Republican on almost all the key issues, but picking a few issues that were very popular and sort of bucking his party. And some of that was just, it's not like he had a strategy to become McCain. Some of that was characterological, but I mean, I think a lot of it was characterological, but he was smart about it. And her things were just, you know, carried interest loophole that like 10 people use, you know, and is, you know, I don't even want to get into all the arguments why it's actually fair. I mean, it's, you know, the people who extremely rich people benefit from it. Even if you could convince me that by some abstract way, it's actually awesome, it would still be super, you know, super unpopular. And, you know, while she was doing this, there were just lots and lots of people, you know, she's going to switch parties or she's going to do that. You know, she's got this master plan and we're mad at her, but she's got it all worked out how, I don't know, you know, somehow she's going to make this work, or she'll run as an independent and screw the Democrats over, or her hedge fund friends are going to give her a $20 million a year job. And that's been her goal all along. And first of all, look, politicians have... There are ways that smart politicians can just kind of get wealthy in office and not break any laws. It's just sort of like there's like a money osmosis that happens for a lot of them, right? Not super wealth, maybe, but they get, you know, a kind of transformed economic status. And there's plenty of time to cash in, serve, you know, serve some time in the Senate. And but the reality is that people work so hard to get one of those Senate seats. And she worked really hard. She was, as you said, Green Party activist. She then got into the state legislature. I think she was in the state house and then the state Senate. Small chance I'm wrong about that, but I don't think so. Worked her way up, finally ran for Senate, got it. You don't do that and just like piss it all away after, you know, after one term. And the whole idea about they're going to like take care of her afterwards. No, they're not, because no one cares. She's not going to, she can't help them now. So yeah, maybe she's going to end up with some job somewhere, but not like some like, you know, set for life kind of thing. And she's not going to be a lobbyist because corporations don't give politicians big dollar lobbyist jobs to thank them. They do it because they have a lot of friends who are still in Congress, and that's valuable. And Kyrsten Sinema has no friends. I'm not saying there are, you know, that everybody hates her, but the Democrats don't like her. She made life really unpleasant for people. And even that kind of, you know, that thing with the thumbs down, the cutesy thumbs down, you know, that's sort of like, it's like a characterological thing somehow. I don't really get it, because that's sort of like, I don't know, unless you're kind of like a Rand Paul or something, people come up with all these reasons like, oh, you can't have minimum wage because it's actually going to hurt the little guy. No one just says, eh, sucks to be you, minimum wage dude. They may think that, but they don't say that. And certainly as a Democrat, you're like, it's a total mystery. And the joke's on her.
It's so strange because every politician has like a pretty massive ego. You know, you can't go through running for office and exposing yourself in that way if you don't. But hers seems so large as to completely kind of divorce her from the everyday calculation that is part of being a politician with any kind of lifespan. You know, it's like, it's as you say, McCain broke with his party on not killing Obamacare, right? Things that were super popular. She broke with her party on a super corporate loophole-y type things that are only exciting to you if you're a hedge fund manager, and then B, broke away on the most popular important things to your base. Like, it was, I mean, it was baffling the whole time. And you just got this sense throughout that she and her staff were kind of chuckling to each other. Like, they thought it was so funny that the press and her party was so confounded by her. But it was never in any kind of ideologically coherent direction. And it wasn't even fully kind of performatively cohesive, because you would think that someone making those kind of decisions is someone who just loves being like the most important pretty princess at the party and wants everyone to pay attention to them. But then that was coupled with her seeming fear of being interviewed by anyone with any rigor, you know, of dealing with the press in any kind of consistent way, of communicating to her voters in any consistent way. You know, she really kept herself kind of isolated and protected from criticism other than from afar. So it was just this mass of contradictions that was so bizarre and galling. I mean, she was so unpopular by the end. I think she was at like 76% disapproval with Arizona Democrats or something, like just unbelievable numbers. So, you know, and it's just, it does put a coda on this era of our producer Jackie put together that mashup of how often we said Manchin and Sinema for that like 2 year span when we had to talk about them all the time. And now they're both done, right? They're both done with politics. Manchin for kind of a less self-inflicted reason than Sinema, but it is kind of a point of reflection that these two people who so, you know, were such gadflies for 2 years and so kind of undermined various pieces of the progressive agenda and then ultimately kind of got on board for the big pieces. But God, did they drag it out in an agonizing way. Like, this is at least the end of that era. And they at the very least have made it completely certain that, you know, filibuster reform and being in favor of it will be a litmus test for every Senate candidate from this point on.
Absolutely. And, you know, I was engaging with some people, I think, on Twitter yesterday, and someone said something like, well, you know, it was crazy, but that's what she said she was going to do when she ran, isn't it? And I'm like, no, not at all. Not at all. I mean, not even remotely. And that is what is so weird about it. You know, she had, as you said, she started out as actually a Green Party activist. She was definitely on the, you know, Iraq War, anti-Bush kind of, you know, aughts kind of part of the Democratic Party. She, you know, in her early runs, she, you know, ran on the billing that she would be, you know, the first bisexual woman to be elected to this and to elected to that. And that's great. I mean, that's sort of, you know, it's an important thing. And that's not, you know, it's not identical to, you know, establishment versus progressive, but it certainly kind of adds to people's sense of kind of where you are politically. And it's true that as she sort of, you know, sort of climbed up the ladder in Arizona state politics, she sort of burnished her, I'm looking for bipartisan solutions, which is something you obviously have to do in a, you know, red trending to maybe purplish state. But, and as you say, for her first 2 years was kind of about what you'd expect, sort of, you know, and she always had that kind of, you know, the flashy outfits and all that kind of thing, which is just part of her personality. And that's great and all that kind of stuff. And she was just out of the gate in 2021. And certainly, you know, I was talking to a lot of Arizona Democrats, and some of these people were more conventional Democrats, some, you know, very much progressives. And obviously in a state like Arizona, you got to get everybody. You know, you got to get the business Democrats. You got to get the far left Democrats. There just aren't enough to go around for you not to be, you know, to have to get everybody on board. And all of these people who, like, you know, I canvassed for her, I phone banked for her, I was giving her $10 a month for 3 years, all this kind of stuff. And they were all just, what the fuck? Like, what the actual fuck? What is going on here? Which, obviously, as we know, with Manchin, it was always like, look, it's a conservative state. We're lucky to have anybody from that state. Total bafflement. And even, but she did manage to kind of keep the newsletters, the Axioses and the Politicos and the Punch Bowls, kind of like, I guess she's got some kind of secret plan. She doesn't care what you think. That's not a great, I mean, it's such a funny line because, like, that's not a great political line. Like, I don't care what you think. Like, what? Like, what? Anyway, we got to get on to other issues, but it's, I will never understand what happened with her. Characterological. Nope.
I just want to end on this anecdote, which I guess when Mitch McConnell announced his impending retirement, she like went up to him afterwards and was like sobbing, like crying and like holding his hands and stuff. And you're just like, I don't know. Maybe she's just like the most successful Republican Party convert of all time. Like maybe she just really fell in love with the grand old party. You know, it's kind of what it seems like. But yeah, I mean, the most kind of baffling, disrespectful politician that we've had in just a long while. On her way out, you know, this is good news for Ruben Gallego. This is great news for Democrats trying to keep the Senate. You know, now it'll be a kind of head-to-head matchup against probably one of the best people the Democrats could have gotten against, pretty undeniably the worst person Republicans could have gotten, with no third party complications going on. Kind of clears the way for Gallego to stop having to run against Sinema and Lake. You know, he can now just focus on Lake. So, you know, in the end, there were pretty rightful concerns, I think, that she would screw over Democrats one more time, like twist the knife, just because it didn't seem beyond the pale that someone like her would act out of sheer vindictiveness and no real political stratagem. But, you know, that didn't come to pass. She's gone. That makes the race easier. Probably, you know, shifts the seat a little safer in Democrats' column. And, you know, farewell. Yes. Less than fond farewell.
you did baffle me, Kirsten, and I will give you that. I've never been, no one has ever baffled me like you, Kirsten Sinema.
Seriously.
I will never forget you. Yeah. All right. So Super Tuesday. So we had, obviously, you know, Trump lost Vermont, which is, you know, kind of like, Vermont. Yeah, it's Vermont. So I guess Nikki Haley will have won DC and Vermont, which is like, you know, Vermont is DC just with trees and more white people. I don't know. It's kind of like it's Vermont, right? So it's these are the kind of places where someone like Nikki Haley would win. Beside that, we had, you know, we had things mostly as expected. We also had this thing where now, okay, so I have talked about a few times this issue of, we keep seeing this thing that a lot of polls seem to be overestimating Trump's margins in these primary states. And this has happened again and again and again. And there's sort of a debate now, you know, okay, great, but does it matter at all? And I think it does matter a bit. A lot of polling types are sort of like, yeah, it's neat, but like it totally doesn't matter, so drop it. And I think I understand why they say that, or at least one good reason why they say that, which is that people, especially in a moment like this where a lot of Democrats are, you know, very nervous about the election, you want to look at that and you mean, well, okay, I'm just going to subtract a few points from Trump in the Biden polls, we're good to go, right? And you can't make linear, you know, you can't extrapolate linear logic like that between a primary electorate and a general electorate. But that doesn't mean it means nothing. I think it probably does mean something. And there were two things that came out today, which were interesting to me about this in very different ways. And one is this guy, Elliot Morris, who now is the sort of the chief guy at 538, had a post about this. And he, as someone who knows polls much better than I, said something that I was kind of like, I could say at the level of grunts and I think and all this kind of stuff. But his point is that these pollsters seem to be, they're having a hard time measuring normie Republicans. Not a huge amount. There aren't many normie Republicans anymore, but they do exist. And in these primaries, that seems to be the issue. They're having a hard time isolating them. And, you know, that gets into sort of non-response rates and polls, and you have to model things and stuff, and assumptions go into it. In any case, if that is true, normie Republicans or Republican-leaning independents are going to be a pretty key variable in the general election. So this isn't some like huge thing. It's just something to kind of keep an eye on. So anyway, that's where that is. Kate, what else happened on Super Tuesday?
So we had Nikki Haley suspended her campaign Wednesday morning, right after the kind of paltry showing on Super Tuesday. I think as soon as we kind of move past the, is she willing to get humiliated in her home state thing, this was probably the clearest kind of end result, because she just kept saying resolutely, you know, I'm in through Super Tuesday, but was pretty clearly not going any further than that. You know, we were starting to get reports coming out about fielding donor questions about what's the game plan here. You know, we're not just going to keep giving you money if there's no path to success, which there pretty clearly hasn't been for some time. So,
and I think there was like no watch parties yesterday. Like
exactly,
she was just kind of
right.
Like having a barbecue at home. So that was sort of a tell.
And so in her speech, really the only kind of interest there was the prop bet of whether or not she would endorse Trump after these past few weeks of kind of going after him pretty aggressively, if she would still do that heel turn to try to get accepted back into the full Republican Party. She did not do that. She did a little perfunctory congratulations and then kind of challenged him to win the support of her moderate voters, which I thought was a little cowardly. Like, you've spent the past few weeks kind of punching at this guy, and I agree not endorsing him is some small performance of courage, but you know Trump is not going to change anything about his campaign to attract these voters, like if he was capable of doing that, because it obviously helps his electoral prospects. We would have seen him do it in, you know, 2019. So it's a little bit of an out, a little bit of a, now I challenge you, Donald. Like, okay. But, you know, it's interesting because now, like, the scramble over the Haley voters, even, you know, despite the fact that he won handily in all these primary races, kind of goes to the point you were making about the difficulty in finding the normie Republicans in these polls, which is, like, fundamentally the problem is that, you know, there aren't many of them anymore. They're really being driven out of the party by Trumpism, anyone who doesn't like it. But they're still a significant block when it comes to the general election. You know, they might be a non-entity in the primary, but as we've said, the general plays out on the margins. Like it doesn't play out with the super MAGAs or the MSNBC Biden lovers, right? It's the people in the middle, and that's where Haley's fans are. These are people who generally find Trump repulsive, really don't want him to be the nominee. A lot of them probably fall into that double hater category. I mean, they also don't like Biden. They're not Democrats by and large, except for the ones who kind of crossed over to help her out.
Or if they were close enough to being Democrats, they're Democrats now. Like if you didn't have strong, if you were a Republican in, you know, 2012, 2016, and you're kind of like, you know, your parents were Republicans, but you kind of like taxes on the low side, but you're not a strong ideologue. After the last 8 years, man, you're a Democrat. You know, if George Conway can become a de facto Democrat, you can too. So they must be ideologically fairly conservative, but just like Trump, no.
Right, exactly. I think you can generally think of these people as like, they're probably like higher on the civic scale, right? These are people who I think are generally kind of lifelong conservatives who probably like really love Ronald Reagan and stuff like that, and find Trump to be an embarrassment, and then find Biden, you know, to be the head of the party they've spent their whole lives kind of demonizing and disliking. So that's
and
where
also
we are now.
That if they see the like Inflation Reduction Act, they're like, dude, that's a ton of spending. Like, I hate that. Right. So, you know, you get why they're still Republicans.
But they're an important group, and they're going to be really important in the general, which is why it's kind of fascinating that Trump's reaction to Haley dropping out is to do, you know, an all caps Truth Social victory lap, because that's fundamentally who he is, right? Like, he's pissed that she challenged him at all. She's pissed that he challenged him as long as she did. He's probably pissed that he lost DC and Vermont and now doesn't get to be, you know, the first non-incumbent to win every primary state. So, you know, that was him, classic Trump, you know, unbound by these kind of consultant-driven pivots we keep hearing are just around the corner. And then you had Biden, whose statement said, "My arms are open." Basically, there's room on my campaign for Republicans who care about, you know, the future of democracy. Even if we don't agree on much else, we are intrinsically bound by that. And that's the most important thing. So, you know, basically, come on over, Haley voters, like, we'd be happy to have you. And I think that is like a big advantage, is that Biden is fundamentally running a grown-ups campaign and Trump is doing a shoot from the hip, emotional impulse of the moment, feeling something is good enough justification to voice it campaign. And I know that like everything feels bleak and, you know, it's been affecting me. And it is so depressing to think that we have a political system where someone like Trump is still viable at this point. But that's a key difference between these two men and the way that their campaigns will be run. And to whatever degree the Biden campaign kind of devotes resources to trying to, you know, identify these Haley voters and start kind of a sway pressure campaign to get them, just hold your nose and vote for Biden, or even just vote against Trump, right? Think of it that way. You know, I think that'll all redound to his benefit. And this like kind of instant reaction to her dropping out, I think indicates that the Biden campaign, you know, is well aware of that and has probably, you know, kind of strategically thought out how to isolate and capture and win over that group of voters that at least, you know, had enough backbone to say, you know, we're not capitulating to this guy who has won over nearly everyone else in our party. I mean, that's not nothing.
Yeah. I mean, a couple thoughts on that. I mean, one is, you know, when she said this thing, you know, he's got to woo them and stuff. Obviously, that is never going to work for Trump. He's going to, you know, he's going to be Trump, and we know who Trump is. One thing that occurs to me there, one part of it that I can understand Trump's reaction is that, you know, you've got a lot in the whole Biden age thing. You've got, or, you know, the Biden age thing, or the, you know, disunity over Gaza, although that's a different thing on many levels. But on the age thing, you've got people like David Axelrod saying he's got to recognize it. He's got to address it. You know, he can't pretend it's not there. That you kind of, you know, they're kind of like Biden. He's like, I'm sorry, I'm so old. You know, like, like, dude, that's not going to work, right? I mean, there's, you know, that kind of thing. You can't ignore it. Well, what are you going to say? He's old, right? So got it. And, you know, so obviously there are ways that a candidate can joke about things and stuff. But I do get in our politics, just the way that, and it may not be just our politics, maybe it's politics everywhere, but at least in anything like our culture, a candidate can't be begging, can't be apologizing for the things that aren't good enough about them. You know, that's why no one likes that. People want someone. I mean, it's in some ways, it's sort of how life works, right? That people want to be around people who are confident and strong and know who they are and, you know, aren't making excuses. I seem to remember, what was it? I think there was like a... I feel like there was like a Saturday Night Live a skit, maybe in the 70s or something, where it was, you know, when MASH was a show, and it was basically kind of like an Alan Alda as the 70s alpha male, you know, kind of neurotic and apologizing, and all the women are like, oh, I got to have a piece of that, right? This is how we function. So she is, I don't think she's really going to stick with it. But by saying, like, you know, what is he going to do? You know, what is he going to do? Like, okay, we know I suck and I'm a belligerent asshole. And can you still love me? I mean, you know, what is he going to say? The other point is on this, you know, on this crossover issue, I saw a lot of people saying, well, what this shows is that a lot of Democrats and, you know, left-leaning independents are crossing over to vote for Haley. And that is probably some of it. I mean, you know, that was a big part of the discussion in New Hampshire, that it's easy, you know, easy to cross over in New Hampshire. But I don't think that works as an explanation. Because a lot of these races are still like 60-30, you know, and change, maybe little, you know, a nugget of support for Dead Bounce Ron or something like that. But basically, this idea of crossover votes in this context is something that only hardcore political people ever think about. It's hard enough to get people to vote, let alone go vote to like own Donald Trump or like own the pollsters or some, that just doesn't happen. You don't get 30% of the electorate Democrats going to vote for Haley to like embarrass her. That doesn't happen. And so there is this question of like, who are these people? Because you did have, again, exit polls, but you know, you also had a lot of people in the Republican primary saying, you know, they're not going to vote for the Republican nominee at all. So that's, I mean, if I'm a Republican, I look at that and say, okay, that's my proof. This is all bullshit. This is just a bunch of Democrats coming over to vote. But again, that doesn't work that way. I think it is some crossovers. I think it's a lot of people who are independents. Some of them are who are Republicans who are just like, I know Haley's not going to be the nominee, but I'm just going to kind of make my point. I don't like Trump. So I don't think this is meaningless. I think these are signals of, you know, one of the basic dynamics that's going to be in this campaign. Obviously, it's not that he's going to like lose a third of Republicans, but everything comes down to small margins. So these things are, I do think they are worth keeping an eye on.
So, you know, from here on out, it's really the general election. We're kind of off to the races now. We've known who the nominees are going to be forever, but with Haley out, it's just, you know, it's mano-a-mano. All the advertising will be directed, you know, for one of them or against the other one. There won't be any of the like kind of internecine news flurries anymore. You know, we're off to the races now. And there are a couple other races that we wanted to talk about from last night, in addition to the presidential ones, which first, we had these three House Democrats running for Dianne Feinstein's seat. And this is like such a plush gig for a Democrat, right? Like, it's no wonder that so many people wanted it. I mean, if you win a California Senate seat as a Democrat, it's like getting appointed to the Supreme Court. That's lifetime tenure. You know, you're absolutely set. And so Adam Schiff, Katie Porter, Barbara Lee all kind of threw their hats into the ring. There was some, from the beginning, I think Schiff had a little bit of an advantage in terms of he kind of claimed the moderate mantle for himself and then left Lee and Porter to kind of duke it out among the progressives, which is the perfect way for the progressives not to win. You know, just there. And it's a shame because in California politics in particular, I think the progressive wing is strong and big enough that it can actually like put up a challenge to these more normie Democrats. But when you have the vote split between two people like that, and then the kind of who might be the groups that might be kingmakers in other contexts largely kind of kept their hands clean, you know, Emily's List involved to kind of boost one of the women. So that's kind of how it played out. And then Schiff did this pretty ruthless play, which ended up working really well, which was that he spent millions on ads kind of bolstering Steve Garvey, who's the token Republican running, who used to be a professional baseball player. All these ads kind of raising his profile for conservatives, right? You know, making fun of him for being MAGA and being Trumpy with the express purpose of getting this guy who has, you know, meaningfully no money in the bank and who didn't air a single ad of his own to get him on Republicans' radar. So they're like, okay, well, I'll vote for him, right? And that had the effect of bumping up Garvey so that Porter and Lee are edged out. And then Schiff and Garvey are the top two getters. Remember, this is the California jungle primary system. So two Democrats could have gone through if they were the top vote getters. But Schiff's little maneuver made sure that Garvey went through with him, cutting off the other two. And now, you know, Schiff is barely going to have to exert himself to win in the general because it's California. You know, a Democrat's going to win. And I think, you know, there's some kind of upsides for the Democratic Party writ large there, which is they don't have to burn a lot of money, you know, on a Democrat v. Democrat Senate seat. They don't really have to worry about that seat much at all at this point. I think the downside is, like, I find it a little bit troubling that, you know, when Feinstein died, Gavin Newsom put in LaFonza Butler into the seat for the express purpose of, you know, having a black woman represent the state again. And now the outcome is going to be that the California Senate delegation won't have a woman for the first time in over 30 years. Like, that's not great. I kind of personally would have liked to see a figure like Katie Porter in the Senate. You know, I have great respect for Barbara Lee as well. But, you know, as you said before we got on the air, Josh, she's more towards the end of her career, right? But Porter has kind of made a name for herself of, you know, she's Warren's protege. She's come up in this kind of like progressive with a special interest in kind of regulatory aggression in, you know, taking CEOs to task in hearings and, you know, being a fan of the CFPB and kind of wanting to go at corporate conservatism and kind of root it out and shine a light on it. And that kind of thing is so missing from the Senate, from Senate Democrats. Like, that ethos is so rare there. I mean, we've talked about Senate brain so many times, but that it just hems in aggressive oversight. And the people in these jobs have generally been there for so long that they don't really have like the hunger to kind of use what resources they have to do this kind of work. You know, that's not even specifically Trumpy work, but the getting at corruption type work, you know, which is why I think Warren and Sanders are both singular in the Senate Democratic caucus and singularly valuable because they are the mouthpiece for this stuff. And it kind of puts them apart from the other normie Democrats who tend to be more, you know, in lockstep with the party. They don't really like to ruffle feathers. Like, maybe they'll get a little aggressive on their pet issues, but by and large, it's just kind of like, you know, go along to get along. And I think it would have been nice to have that small flank of the Senate Democratic Party kind of bolstered by someone else with those aggressive tendencies that's a bit less like beholden to the institutionalism. And I think Schiff is definitely going to fall more into the, you know, the normie Democrat camp, right? Like, he was just kind of one of those workhorsey type people until he was tapped to do the impeachment, and then that raised his profile and he went on TV a bunch and he was really loyal to Nancy Pelosi, so he got her endorsement and her fundraising and like all that mm-hmm. kind of put him on a glide path. But, you know, he was part of like the Democratic, I forget his exact name, but it's for like, you know, pro-business Democrats. Like, that's where his kind of allegiances lie.
DLC? So, Democratic yeah. Leadership Council? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that might be right. One of those kind of bland named things that just means like, I'm a Democrat, but don't worry, businesses, don't be scared of me. So that's kind of my disappointment, I guess. But that being said, like, fundamentally, I don't think a Senator Katie Porter would vote meaningfully differently than a Senator Adam Schiff. The same way I don't think a Senator Bernie Sanders votes meaningfully differently than, you know, a Senator Bob Casey. Like, when it comes down to it, you know, a Democrat is a Democrat. But like I said, I think it would have been nice to have that voice in a body that is so allergic to kind of aggressive action.
Yeah, I mean, I think that even more, as you say, I mean, the commonality of voting among Senate Democrats, especially in such a polarized era, is probably, you know, well over 90%, you know, kind of across the board. I think even more than that, if you look at voting, Schiff and Katie Porter, probably very little voting difference between them in the House, and I suspect in the Senate, but there's a texture issue that is very different. You know, Katie Porter is one of these, you know, young progressives in the Warren mold. And as much as, you know, Bernie and Warren, they have very different life trajectories. They're kind of, you know, there's a tonal difference, even though they support a lot of the same things. And, you know, so Katie Porter is one of these people like, let's seriously get into it about political economy, Kate. I got my whiteboard here. Let's do it, right? Let's talk about regulation. And that's her. And that's great. And you see that in, like, you know, in-house hearings and stuff. And, you know, Adam Schiff is, I don't know, just much more conventional. And I don't think of him, you know, he's going to be totally for reproductive rights and the ACA and probably, you know, for the I forget the order of the acronyms now, but, you know, Warren's consumer financial protection board and all that kind of stuff. But it's just different. He's a more conventional, like, I'm not even sure he's more conventional in any practical sense of voting, but he's a very different character. There's no question. And I, from the beginning, found this whole thing a bummer because I like both of them. I wanted them both to be in Congress. And once they decided to both compete for this, someone had to lose and she lost. And that's a bummer. I can't imagine that this will be the, you know, I think she'll be back in some, I mean, look, if Democrats don't hold her House seat, I suspect she'll be back in 2 years going after that House seat again. And, you know, it's funny. The thing is with Steve Garvey, I'm doing all these things to show my age in this episode. In the 70s, the Dodgers had a infield squad that was Steve Garvey, Ron Say, Bob Russell, Davey Lopes, and Steve Yeager. And except for Steve Yeager, they were like something like almost every Dodger game for about a decade, more or less in the 70s, maybe 72 to 73 was them. Yeager was part of it. So when I was a little kid, Steve Garvey, he's the first base dude, right? So kind of like Steve Garvey, like, oh, Steve Garvey, like, to me, he's not some, like, you know, obscure guy who played baseball once. He was like a big guy in LA, but he sort of, like, I think as soon as he left the Dodgers, he switched from baseball to affairs, right? And that kind of took a bit of the shine off his celebrity. One of the things is his then wife, before Regis Philbin became Regis and Kathy Lee and all that stuff on the East Coast, he had the morning show in LA, and it was Regis and I think Cindy Garvey, and that was the first iteration of Regis, like back in the 70s, basically. So you learn something new every episode of this podcast. Anyway, so then he gets traded, like, to the Padres, and then, like, he, like, has 100 affairs, and everybody's like, how could you do Cindy like that, dude? What the fuck? So that's Garvey. But it's a funny thing, you know, it's a funny thing in general with California Senate races, because sometimes you get it where it's two Democrats, and then it's just sort of like, in partisan terms, you're like, who cares? Right? Like, whatever. That's a Democratic seat. But you have this funny dynamic where, since it is basically impossible for a Republican to win a Senate seat, you get weirdos like Steve Garvey. Because no politician's going to do it. Why do you want to do it? You're going to lose. So you always have to get some, like, has-been weirdo like Steve Garvey or some, like, CEO who is just like an ego trip, right? And so now you're going to, you know, I mean, Schiff's going to win, like, you know, 65-35. And there we are. That's a history lesson for today's podcast.
more of this scintillating content after these messages.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Back to the show. And just really quickly before we move off California, I don't want to get the sense that we're being, you know, dismissive of the one Black woman who is in this race, who has had an esteemed political career and has maybe the record of taking like the bravest votes of anyone in Congress, particularly being the sole member of Congress who voted against, you know, the use of military force, e.g. the Afghanistan war after 9/11. I mean, that takes a tremendous amount of courage and foresight. And since then, you know, she's been a steady progressive. Most recently, she's kind of been vocal about, you know, calling for a ceasefire a lot earlier than other politicians were. And I think she was pretty immediately overlooked in this race, not least because Katie Porter has a pretty large fundraising base, in part because her hearing performances made her into somewhat of a kind of hero among this segment of Democrats.
She had also, even before she got she won her first election, she had built a surprisingly strong fundraising base among kind of LA liberals, right? Mm-hmm. So that only blossomed after that. So yeah, she was a powerhouse and is a powerhouse. She's not done, but you know. Yeah.
And then, you know, as soon as Schiff was already kind of working in these upper echelons. And then as soon as he got the Pelosi endorsement, and Pelosi is like one of the most prodigious fundraisers that Congress has ever seen. So Lee was kind of like cut out of the equation right away because of those factors. And, you know, I just want to put out there that part of it too is like she represented, you know, for her career has represented a much poorer district than the other ones. You know, like Porter is from Orange County, you know, like it was. So she had all these like institutional disadvantages. I think part of her decision probably does hinge on the fact that she's getting old. You know, she was probably like more kind of content to throw her hat into the ring. And if it didn't work, okay. I mean, it's been a long and illustrious career. So all those institutional factors were working against her. But I don't want to leave with the impression that she was like a non-serious candidate by any means. And I am pretty amenable to the argument that, you know, being a Black woman without this kind of like legion of online fans, you know, who represents Oakland and is like struggling in the fundraising game, like that all of that stuff didn't kind of unfairly take her out of a race that she should have been a more serious contender in. And I think that argument also works to perhaps open up Porter to a little bit more criticism, because she ultimately did not perform very well. You know, she came in with like 16% and Schiff had 30, and she didn't have the money raising problems that Barbara Lee did.
Lee wasn't even that far behind. Yeah, yeah. I mean, not dramatically behind. I mean, it's, you know, your point that she basically represents Oakland. I don't know exactly where, I think she does. I don't know exactly where that district is now, but she's basically the successor. I mean, literally the successor. I don't mean metaphorically, to Ron Dellums. That seat, I mean, obviously the seat has, the district has been redistributed a few times, but that was Ron Dellums' seat. And Ron Dellums, she has been in that seat for about 25 years. Ron Dellums, I think, was in Congress for a good 30 years, part of the sort of the first generation. I mean, there were Black members of Congress back well into the 20th century, but the generation of Black representatives, at, you know, kind of during and after the civil rights movement, founding the Congressional Black Caucus, stuff like that, very, very left wing from a generally fairly poor district. So there's a whole part of left-wing Democrat African-American politics that both of them come out of, you know, come out of that. So yeah, it's a lot happened there. I mean, there's some good things about the jungle primary thing, but these kind of things aren't one of them. I think when Kamala Harris won her Senate seat. I believe I'm the woman's name is escaping me. I think she was running against a representative from Southern California. So it was one of those ones where it was two Democrats against each other. So there's a whole history of that.
So before we depart Super Tuesday, and you know, forgive us for running a little long today. It's been a very full news week. We wanted to touch on the absolute lunatic who won the North Carolina Republican gubernatorial primary in perhaps the greatest gift to Democrats since Carrie Lake intimidated the GOP chair out of trying to get someone else to run there. So Mark Robinson won the primary, who is currently lieutenant governor and who's kind of been on the radar for a while. I mean, TPM's done quite a bit of reporting about him, as have other outlets, because he's got this like huge history of posting the most unhinged stuff imaginable on his social media, because he was not at all involved in politics until like 2018, where he gave this speech right after the Parkland shooting, a kind of rah-rah pro-gun speech that went super viral on like, you know, right-wing internet. And that alone kind of bolstered him into North Carolina politics. But because of that, and because of, I think, just a sense of like defiance that I can say what I want, would probably explain why he still hasn't scrubbed all this stuff. But he's got this prodigious history of just beyond the pale unhinged stuff, even for today's Republican Party. You know, he's got a touch of Holocaust denialism, some Hitler quoting, the most, you know, horrible things about gay and trans people. You know, I mean, literally calling gay people filth and maggots, and, you know, saying that bisexual people should have to go to the bathroom outside with the dog, you know, that women are made to serve men, you know, that all abortion is murder, you know, on and on and on and on and on and on. And like, just really kind of crazy, beyond the pale type stuff. And this is the guy who's going to be the Republican candidate for North Carolina governor, which we know is a winnable seat for Democrats, and which perhaps most importantly, Democrats now get to make this guy like the face of at least North Carolina Republicans, if not the Republican slate in general. And that's huge for Biden because, you know, North Carolina in particular has been the state that is so like aggravating to Democrats because it's always right on the edge, right? Like you always think it's the next Arizona, it's the next Georgia, it's the next one that's going to fall in line, you know, both due to kind of demographics and the way it's trended and the way that it's been close, you know, it's been close, and that you had a Democrat, you know, win governor there. It's just, it's not out of reach.
And senators relatively recently won, right? You know, there were Democratic senators there.
And the Republican, at least the statewide Republicans there tend to be of the more muted brand, right? Like Tom Tillis in the Senate right now is from North Carolina. It tends to be more of the purpley, I'm usually in the bipartisan coalitions. Like, you know, they'll probably endorse Trump, but they're not like super pumped about it. That's the brand, right? Yeah. And now you've got this like nut job who's going to run for the Republicans. And that is just kind of a gift because the Biden campaign's been saying for months, and people have made fun of them, but they've been saying for months, North Carolina's in play and we are making a real go at it. And I think this is like what a kind of vindication of that strategy.
And for our listeners, for, you know, there's a part of this equation that is really critical, and that is that Robinson's Black. And I think one of the ways that and a lot of his stuff is just like really racist. And I don't mean racist against like Hispanics and Asians. I mean against Black people. So, you know, and I think that part of how he has been, as Kate said, he went viral. And, you know, they've done something similar in a gubernatorial candidate will often grab some like viral person to like, oh, put him a lieutenant governor, give my campaign a little spark. And that's what, you know, kind of a version of that is what happened here. But I do think it is one of the ways he's had a little more flexibility, certainly about saying like super racist things, but also like Holocaust denial things, because there's always a sense of like, can he really be that racist? He's black. Like what? You know, kind of. So that's given him a little flexibility. But, you know, and I should say that I can't remember exactly when it was, sometime in like middle of 2023, Hunter Walker, our reporter here at TPM, did a whole expose of this guy based on his, you know, social media past. And as Kate said, he hasn't scrubbed any of this stuff. And it's basically to imagine who this guy is. Imagine some like just freak show person on Twitter or Facebook. And I think Facebook is more this guy's thing. Just the memes, the this and the that. And, you know, that's the kind of having someone like that at the top of the ticket is something that makes that will make me look a little more seriously at North Carolina. Because when you have someone like that, just a freak show like that, you know, that's going to give people a little pause. And it's absolutely true that it's been this, it was, you know, kind of a holy grail for Democrats, has been forever. And what was really heartbreaking for Democrats is that it was a holy grail. It got closer and closer. And then Obama won it once. I think he won it in 8 and maybe not in 12. So basically trending. And then it trended back, right? Which was even more heartbreaking for him. But this is a significant thing. And again, this is, we tend to think kind of like, you know, as we always say, nothing matters anymore. People can say anything. But that's not true. He is a Kerry Lake type person. So that's a real development.
And honestly, I didn't even remember that in 2020 it had been this close. But Trump won North Carolina then with about 50%, and Biden got like 49. I mean, that was really close last time.
Totally.
And as important as it is to maybe help the top of the ticket, you know, it also, having a nut show helps down ballot as well, because, you know, Democrats will be charged up to come out and vote against this guy. Republicans will inevitably, at least some of them, find him repugnant and, you know, stay home or, you know, not switch votes or whatever. But this kind of thing is really critical because, like, look what's happening in Wisconsin, right? Like, part of the problem in North Carolina is it is so gerrymandered that its legislature has become completely unhinged. And that has had real effects, because when Roy Cooper won the governor's mansion, who's a Democrat, that's where this strategy of like completely defanging the governor's power came from. You know, they stripped away all this authority from him, which then in turn makes the state even more Republican, right? And the only way that you unwind that stuff is what we're seeing in Wisconsin, when you get, you know, Democrats into these kind of like high caliber positions. And then with time, you know, then you get a Janet Protasiewicz or whatever, you know, you remake the state court, all of a sudden the maps go down and it's a totally different ball game.
Yeah, it's very similar. You get the super majorities, and then, but when you actually have statewide races, especially for governor, Democrats win those. The other thing is, and I will, this is a great opening, because I have a friend who's running for the state Senate in North Carolina. This guy who I have known this guy for 20 years. He's a TPM reader, but I consider him a close friend.
Say no more.
His name is Darren Staley, and you know, a great guy, just a dear friend of mine, and has an amazing life story. In any case, people are always saying, you got to field someone in every race, right? Because it's one of these things where you sort of, you have an area that is really conservative, but there's also never a Democrat running. So it's just people, you know, it just, it kind of locks in. And Darren is running, obviously it's where he lives, in I think what is either the most Republican state Senate district, or if not the most, you know, close to the most. And he's doing it for two reasons. One is just that he's very committed to his political ideals. We're now moving it to three reasons. The other is that people should show up literally and metaphorically and contest races. And so, you know, you're out there in some district around the country, get in, right? And the other thing, though, is I think that there are many parts of there are many parts of the country where you have districts that are, you know, totally Republican, but what the people, there are undercurrents there, but also like everybody's on the ACA, right? And so there's undercurrents there that someone who really knows the district, and, you know, we say knows the district, that's kind of political talk and what are the technical political things, but knows the district. What is life like in that district? And what are people like? And how do they grow up? And what are their life experiences? So anyway, dear friend of mine is running there. This will help him. This will help him, having someone like a Robinson there. Look, it's a long shot. It's a long shot race. I think if you asked the Wasserman types or whatever, they would say it's totally hopeless. But, you know, Darren is raising money and, you know, stranger things happen. So I'm particularly happy about this North Carolina thing because, you know, look, I don't endorse people. I don't do anything like that. But there's no rule against me saying who my friends are. Right. So anyway, that's that story. And that's a little nugget about North Carolina.
And it's the, you know, it's this dynamic we see over and over, which is you have to be super MAGA right wing to win a Republican primary in a way that makes it impossible for you to temper yourself for the kind of more moderate taste of the general electorate. So, you know, playing out yet again. OK, we're going to kind of go warp speed here because this feels like it happened so long ago to me, but it was after our last recording, which is the Supreme Court ruled on the disqualification case out of Colorado. Our listeners, I am very positive, know by now that they ruled Colorado can't kick Trump off the ballot, which is what basically all of us expected after oral arguments. It was pretty clear even then that at least Kagan and Jackson were both more on the conservative thought train in terms of not liking the idea that a state could remove a federal candidate from its ballot. And that is kind of how it played out, but not really. I mean, technically, it was a per curiam decision, which means, you know, unanimous. But the concurring decision from the liberals was so critical that it read like a partial dissent. And then we kind of found out later from some people were playing around with the metadata, and it looked as if they originally had planned for Sotomayor to write a dissent, and it kind of morphed into a per curiam decision.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And so basically the majority said, you know, they can't kick them off, which is the only question presented, right? And then they went further and they said, also, this needs to be a kind of specific type, though they didn't go into the specifics, but of legislative mechanism, e.g. Congress has to pass a law to enforce this part of the Constitution. Which that's the part that the liberals got really mad about, because it's like nobody's asking us to decide that. Like, all we had to say to decide this case is Colorado, you can't do this, right? And instead, now the majority is kind of forcing upon everyone this mechanism that in real terms is going to be impossible to use, right? And they pointed out the tension of this idea that it's written into the Constitution that Congress can lift the quote unquote disability that, you know, you're disqualified for being an insurrectionist. They can lift that with a 2/3 vote, but then it would only take a simple majority to, you know, repeal the law that enforces this part of the Constitution or to never enact it at all, which would render it completely toothless, right? So the liberals are saying they used this case to make sure that future insurrectionists can't be kept off the ballot because you need this law. You can no longer just like take these people to court and say under the disqualification clause, you know, you can't run. That won't work anymore. And then they pointed out that actually, the other disqualifications that we have in the Constitution don't need a law to enforce them, right? Like, we don't have a law that on top of the Constitution to say presidents can only serve 2 terms or, you know, you must
or they
be,
have to the, be 35.
This yeah. is the you must be 35 law. Like those things being in the Constitution is enough. It's just here that all of a sudden we need an additional mechanism on top of it kind of conveniently. So ultimately, you know, they wrote a concurrence. Barrett wrote a concurrence too, basically saying the majority shouldn't have done this, but like in a quieter, like a less angry way, I guess. So that's how it came down. I think this was in some ways less surprising than the decision to take up immunity and to not go to arguments for like a month and a half. We all kind of saw this coming. It just seemed like there's no realistic way for a question that does have valid arguments on both sides that the conservatives are going to be like, nah, Trump, you're off the ballot. Like, I buy it, right? So it ultimately left less of an impression with me. I'm at the point where it's just, I think the way to preserve your sanity is like, we as a country are not going to be saved by any kind of trick plays, whether they be legal or political. It's best to just like assume this is going to come down to the old fashioned things that elections come down to, and, you know, not put your precious heart on the Supreme Court to kind of like bail everyone out. How'd you come down on it, Josh?
Well, you know, I have always been much more equivocal and uncertain about the merits of this whole idea. I was totally for the people who were trying to get it litigated. That's great. I don't buy this idea like, oh, that's it's too weird. Let's not like file a lawsuit. Go for it. Go for it. He led an insurrection against the United States. It is at least totally legit to say he should not be on the ballot. What you actually do about it, I've been much less certain about. There are a lot of ways in which we don't let states decide things like, you know, we don't let states do term limits, right, for federal. So it's, I have always been at least at best equivocal about this. And I don't necessarily disagree with the basic decision of them saying, this isn't up to a state. This is not up to a state. So I'm kind of in a different place than a lot of people are on that one. But it is an example of, it used to be the case, and it is supposed to be the case, that judges are always looking for, okay, a question has been brought before us. We have to address the question. That's our job. But how do we address that question in the most limited way that we can, with, you know, just be surgical? What is the least we can do? Because we're not legislators. And this was clearly a case, and I think that the four of them, ironically, for, you know, the four women were on the same page on this, to say, all we have to say is, you can't do it. And then if they say, well, who does do it? Well, we don't have to address that. This isn't not, right. That's not before us. So we don't have to get in that. And frankly, I'm not sure who does do it. And that's one of the reasons that I wasn't sure a state couldn't do it, because, I think the reality to this is that this definitely does not only apply to the Civil War in the 1860s, but it was written in such a way, in a context in which everybody knew who had either served in the served in a political office under the Confederacy, or served in the Confederate Army. That was just straightforward. There's no, you know, there's kind of no question there. So again, I'm saying something very specific. I'm not saying it only applies there, but the mechanism for how this works is a little fuzzy. And again, that's why I'm very equivocal about it. But it is another example of how this court is just in the habit now of saying, you know, it's kind of like they're getting together for drinks. How should we do this? Okay, my idea is there should be a law, and, you know, the Chief Justice, the Chief Justice calls the top senators to his house, and they figure, like, what? Like, what are you talking about, right? That kind of, they're so used to being a de facto legislature that that minimalism, that judicial minimalism, is just out the window. And so, it is a rare case where I think that they had kind of a free shot to help Trump, because there were very legitimate arguments on both sides. And that's kind of where I am about this court. I think this court is thoroughly corrupt, and I don't use that term loosely. I think they will do everything that is in any way plausible to help the electoral interests of the Republican Party. That's why I don't think they're going to say that he has immunity. But like, there's no rule that they can't treat it as like ordinary, ordinary court business. Hey, we're going to have we'll have arguments in a couple months. You know, no one can, everybody can be mad, but no one can say like, wow, that is such a betrayal. And so they're always, so that's just my assumption. And that at a minimum, that leaves one open to less heartache, right? That you're not disappointed in these people. Although I must say I was, even though I say that, I was still angry. And frankly, I was most pissed off at the three liberals.
I know. I find it staggering that they didn't say anything.
Yeah.
Like, even if you buy the kind of most generous argument, which is the Supreme Court should be the last word on big questions like this, on big questions that are largely like untested and have no kind of case law behind them, there's nothing to say they couldn't say, we agree that we need to get our eyes on this case and we think it should have happened tomorrow. Like, that speed is of the essence, and that delay is a win by another name for a party in this case. You know, I don't understand. I kind of thought when they initially rejected Jack Smith's request to take it up immediately and send it to the DC Circuit, the only way that made sense to me, again, with no dissents from the liberals, was some kind of backroom deal where they were like, fine, we'll send it to the DC Circuit, but that's it, right? We're not taking it up after that. Like, it, from then on out, it is a full tilt and we are not going to intervene. And the fact that that wasn't the case, and that they are clearly, the conservatives here are trying to push this case past the election, you know, for Trump. The fact that that wasn't enough to like engender any kind of angry reaction, you know, even taking in all these like think pieces I've seen about, well, you know, like the liberals can't piss off the conservatives. They need them to cross the aisle on some decisions. It's like, it's a 6-3, like they're done, right? They're basically, their role right now is to like be a voice for posterity about the corrupt shit that was going down in the court, and it's their job to speak up about this and like make very transparent what's going on here.
Yeah, and it doesn't even have to be angry. You can just say, I wasn't on board with this, you know, and there's judicial speak ways to say that, right? And there's also absolutely nothing wrong, and again, this is why I was disappointed, because I thought that there was maybe some deal there that you, and this was the logic of it in my mind, that maybe they don't want to touch it because it's so hot. Let's give it to the DC Circuit. Their names are going to be on it. Their reasoning, as long as it's basically, you know, basically solid, we'll look at it and say, yep, looks good. And that gives them a little insulation from it. You know, Trump won't be mad at them, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, it is... I was surprised for that reason, and it's very disappointing with the liberal justices. And, you know, it's just kind of they lose track of why they're there. And that's a big thing to say, but this was the chain of events that, you know, really made me lose respect and confidence in the, you know, the three Democrat appointees.
My last point here is just like, you know, I mean, it'd be shocking if the Supreme Court comes down on the immunity question in a way that's meaningfully different than the way that the DC Circuit did, which, I mean, even the dyed-in-the-wool conservatives, like you can't come down differently and say, yes, Mr. President, you can assassinate your political rival with impunity. Like, it's crazy. So it's just also galling that now we're going to lose months, you know, months in which voters should know if Trump has been found guilty of inciting an insurrection before the election. Like, they should know. And that seems, you know, ever greater in doubt. So, you know, just yet another kind of infuriating, unjust turn of events from the Supreme Court. How appropriate on the heels of McConnell's departure, the man who's most responsible for it than anybody else.
Absolutely. And we have, you want to say it about the state? Yeah, go for it.
I was just going to conclude this chock full episode, as if we don't have enough going on. Tomorrow, Thursday, will be probably the most important State of the Union of my political consciousness. This will be Biden's kind of biggest audience, definitely before the convention, potentially before the election. It feels like it comes at a really important time when we're the general election is, you know, we're switching gears, we're going in that direction. He's fending off, concerns about his age and his vitality, concerns about his ability to handle, bafflingly, the economy, and then things like immigration and crime, you know, his best chance to kind of make the thesis statement for the second term. So it'll be a big night for the performative and the substantive reasons. We'll be covering it here at TPM, you know, we'll be live blogging, all that kind of good stuff. So, you know, if you like me, have had just a nice little pool of acid in your stomach for the past week or so, come on over, you'll be in good company.
Yeah, we'll be covering it as you'd expect. And yeah, it's a lot. And look, I mean, President Biden is a recovering stutterer. He's not a great public speaker. He never has been. So people like Kate are going to use some of your subscription money to purchase some Xanax for Kate to take tomorrow night. But it is, you know, but there's a lot on the line. It's true. Although, you know, it's also true. He did really,
he did
very well last year. You know, he sort of knocked it around with, Marjorie Greene and Lauren Boebert and, you know, kind of, basically taunted them into, you know, kind of admitting they wanted to cut Social Security and stuff. So don't count the big guy out, as they say in Republican investigations land. So a long episode. Hope you enjoyed it. I think that's all we got. Am I right?
I think that's it. Yep.
All right. Later.
The Josh Marshall Podcast is hosted by me, TPM reporter Kate Riga, and TPM founder, editor-in-chief Josh Marshall. The show is produced by Jackie Wilhelm. Thanks to Why Not Jansfeld for our podcast theme song, and thanks to all our TPM members who make this possible. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and subscribe wherever you listen.